491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California to the New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 324, recorded on September 13th, 2020. This week, we're going to be doing part two of our Pinkertons episode that we started last week. Welcome back to the show, Rachel.
Good to be here.
So last week we talked about the Pinkertons as an armed guard force and some of their private security roles that are ongoing to present day. Today, however, we're going to be talking about the Pinkertons detective agency role in infiltrating labor movements and trying to disrupt union formation and strikes through infiltration rather than armed confrontation in the Second Industrial Revolution period and all the way to the Great Depression. And then Rachel is going to talk about their current activities as well as some of the peer companies that still engage in some of these similar type of labor infiltration practices. So again, the book that we were mainly relying on for the historical sections last week is one we're relying on again this week. This is the book Inventing the Pinkertons, or Spies, Sleuths, Mercenaries, and Thugs, Being the Story of the Nation's Most Famous or Infamous Detective Agency by S. Paul O'Hara, Johns Hopkins University Press, 2016. So as I said, last week we talked about their activities in terms of strike breaking, but we also, with armed force, but we also talked about how they had like infiltrated the anarchist groups to provide false testimony regarding the Haymarket bombings and things like that. So in addition to infiltrating labor societies like the Molly Maguires or labor radicals like the Chicago anarchists, infiltrating nascent union activities and exaggerating threats to the capitalist owners who paid the Pinkertons became the bread and butter of the Pinkertons financially, particularly as their armed guard role either became less socially acceptable or was outright outlawed by various governments in the United States. So in the chapter on Private Army of Capital, the Pinkertons' role is that. S. Paul O'Hara notes that a secret advertisement to businesses from the Pinkertons was leaked at one point in the 1890s, which outlined their services against labor organization. Quote, corporations are individuals desirous of ascertaining the feeling of their employees and whether they are likely to engage in strikes or are joining in any secret labor organizations with a view of compelling terms from corporations or employers can obtain on application to the superintendent of either of the Pinkerton offices a detective suitable to associate with their employees and obtain this information. It is frequently the case that by taking a matter of this kind in hand in time and discovering the ringleaders and dealing promptly with them, serious trouble may be avoided in the future. Now, a lot of what we talked about last week was the Pinkertons' armed guard role in the East Coast or, you know, Midwestern industrial cities. And in a lot of cases, they could go and hire people pretty quickly who didn't have any particular connection to the people that were on strike. And so they could be brought in to, you know, beat them up or shoot them or whatever. And it wasn't that big of a deal for the Pinkertons to do that. However, in more sparsely populated areas such as the Mountain West, this was not really a viable strategy. It would have been probably cost prohibitive to be shipping in armed strike breakers, I think, is my sense from reading the book, from, you know, places like Chicago or thereabouts to, say, Denver or Boise or someplace like that. So there's a whole chapter in the book on the closed frontier of the Mountain West, and that was sort of where their infiltration function was much more predominant than their guard functions in the East. So in the 1890 census, the frontier was considered to be closed, and the western role of the Pinkertons was already shifting away from its functions of glorified bounty hunting and bank or train robbery investigations from the so-called Wild West days, and more toward its conventional role within consolidated capitalism, although they still sometimes spied on various rough characters and troublemakers on behalf of territorial or state governments in the West. And, of course, famously, they were certainly pursuing Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and their Wild Bunch gang as late as 1899 and several years after that. So it wasn't a completely seamless transition to this new role. But it is important to understand that with the closing of the frontier and you're moving away from, as we've talked about on previous episodes, the individual guys going out to a gold rush site or something like that and trying to, you know, pan for gold or stake a claim, that kind of thing. All these different things, as we talked about in agriculture as well in the West, you start getting major capital forces from the major cities coming in and saying, all right, we're going to industrialize the processes of mining and farming and ranching and all these other things. We're going to have these huge landowners and that kind of thing come in and replace some of these smallholders. And the Pinkertons were there to provide services to these major capital formations. So in the East, they had been working for factory owners, but in the West, they were working on labor infiltration and some armed guard functions on behalf of mine owners and ranching tycoons. Now, on an episode a while back on the show, we talked about some of the mining-related labor militancy and strikes in Idaho, but one that we didn't talk about as much was the first conflict at Coeur d'Alene, Idaho in 1892. The more famous one is the one that happened at the end of the, very end of the 19th century. This is several years before that. This was a literally explosive conflict that was happening simultaneously with the Homestead Strike in Pennsylvania that we talked about a lot last week. The conflict in Coeur d'Alene resulted in the U.S. Army intervening, creating detention camps for strikers and imposing military rule for 4 months. And this was the direct result of Union anger over being infiltrated by high-level Pinkerton operatives. This also served to provide a model for the company as the Homestead. This also served to provide capitalists with a model as the Homestead Strike had. Pinkertons would serve as infiltration of the unions, but state militias and federal troops would come in for the actual armed suppression instead of Pinkerton armed guards doing it. This model was repeated in the 1899 strike at Coeur d'Alene, which we discussed in episode 220. Often, the governors would act quickly to move in troops at the first signs of strikes provoked by Pinkerton agents, given that striking miners could detonate large quantities of explosives to disrupt the mine, or if scab workers incompetently detonated the mines by accident, even if there was no other violence. So there was an incentive for a government intervention very quickly with the mines in a way that was not necessarily true for Eastern factories. The Denver office operations in the entire Mountain West region were generally overseen by James McParland, who had been the very first infiltration agent of the Pinkertons ever back in the early 1870s with the Molly Maguires in Pennsylvania. Controversially, as we talked about on that previous episode, the Pinkertons also illegally kidnapped Bill Haywood, a future IWW co-founder from Wyoming, and delivered him across state lines to stand trial in Idaho on false charges, which proved to be another blow for the Pinkertons. Another blow against the Pinkertons in public opinion, as we discussed in those previous episodes, particularly given Clarence Darrow's vicious skewering of them during the trial while serving as defense counsel. One of Darrow's star witnesses was a Pinkerton stenographer at the Denver office named Morris Friedman, who had access to lots of files and went on to publish a book called The Pinkerton Labor Spy that stripped away whatever remaining mystique the agency had. He compared the agency's anti-labor persecution to that of the Imperial Russian Secret Police, and apparently it came to light later that the Russian Secret Police literally once paid the Pinkertons to follow a Russian liberal on a U.S. trip. You know, they were working for the Tsar. This was before the Soviet Union. He also alleged that he had been routinely ordered to doctor reports from regional agents and spies to greatly inflate the threat posed by organized labor so that the Denver office could sell more contracts to spooked tycoons. The book was followed, by Morris Friedman was then followed by a tell-all book by one of the top Pinkerton agents in the Mountain West, Charles Siringo, whose falling out with the agency led him to spill a lot of their secret activities and provocations, many of which he had himself led. He even acknowledged Pinkerton fabrications of evidence against Chicago anarchists in relation to the Haymarket trial, although he personally railed against labor unions in the book himself as well. And then, final point from the book on this topic, in the chapter on the rise of the state, despite all of their efforts to stop unions from forming in the first place, many unions did form. So then the next stage was for the Pinkertons to keep infiltrating those unions once they had been established. Labor infiltration by the Pinkertons continued, but guard functions and increasingly detective functions were taken over by new state forces and agencies, as well as competing private detective services. Other companies also specialized in scab labor provision and took that function away from the Pinkertons because the reputation of the Pinkertons was so damaged that it was dangerous for new companies that were trying to brand themselves as families as a way of trying to stop labor organization, right? These are the companies that say, oh, you don't need a union. We're like a family. And you can't really hire the guys who are known to hire scab labor and shoot crowds of strikers. So they started looking for other companies. But the Pinkertons remained this very important force in terms of labor infiltration all the way into the Great Depression. So in 1936, Senator Robert La Follette, the progressive from the upper Midwest, took advantage of growing fears of fascism and the sense that private bands of armed thugs working for industrialists was closer to Mussolini's black shirts or Hitler's brown shirts than anything else. And so he used that as a pretext, kind of conflating the two issues of their armed guard functions from before, as well as their labor infiltrations, as a pretext to convene hearings specifically targeting all of the Pinkertons' remaining activities and crimes that were being overlooked up until that point. La Follette especially focused on the notion that spying and infiltration of labor by the Pinkertons and their competition was an unfair restraint against the rights of workers of free speech and free assembly. The La Follette investigation found that American labor unions were filled to the gills with undercover private spies working on behalf of not only the corporations, but also middle and lower managers, sometimes just going off and hiring them on their own without official sign-off from the company, because, of course, if you were the lower manager who busted up an some particular union activity or nascent union, then that would probably help you get promoted. In some cases, the spies had actually risen to positions of power within the unions, various leadership roles, without being detected or exposed as Pinkerton spies. In 1937, as a result of these investigations by La Follette, Pinkerton and competitor companies were compelled to dissolve their anti-union spying divisions. Although, of course, as Rachel is about to talk about, these legacies live on in other forms to the present day, including the Pinkerton Division of Securitas AB themselves, which we talked about last week. So Rachel, could you talk to me now about what the Pinkertons specifically are doing in terms of labor infiltration, and also what some of their sort of competitor companies are doing for the major technology firms and other sort of giant corporations now?
Right. So first I'll start with a 2018 Guardian article talking about how Silicon Valley tech firms often surveil their workers outside of work hours. So Pinkerton, as we talked about before, is kind of this intelligence agency that offers kind of investigations on workers' activities and what they're doing. In Silicon Valley, Pinkerton offers to send investigators to coffee shops or restaurants near a company's campus to eavesdrop on employees' conversations. So this is to kind of clamp down on like IP leaks, product information, business venture information, stock information. So one of these managing director at Pinkerton is quoted as saying, "If we hear anything about a new product coming or new business ventures or something to do with stocks, we'll feed that information back to corporate security." So their focus is kind of insider trading or IP theft, ostensibly. Facebook and Google deny using these services. However, through LinkedIn searches, The Guardian found that former Pinkerton investigators have been hired subsequently by Facebook, Google, and Apple. So it's kind of a open secret that these companies are keeping tabs on their employees and tracking their activities outside of work. More recently, in April of 2020, The Verge came out with an article talking about how Amazon and Whole Foods specifically, which is owned by Amazon, is has created a unionization heat map that uses several different metrics to kind of rank which Whole Foods stores are at higher risk of unionization and at higher labor activities. So there's a few categories of risk: external risks, store risks, and team member sentiment. So external risks are local union membership size, distance in miles between the store and the closest union, number of charges filed with the National Labor Relations Board alleging labor law violations, and also what is called a, quote, labor incident tracker, which logs incidents related to organizing and union activity, and also the percentage of families within the store's zip code that fall below the poverty line, and also the local unemployment rate. So zeroing in on the store risks are average store compensation, average total store sales, a diversity index that represents the racial and ethnic diversity of every store. So a lower diversity index equals a higher risk of unionization, because it's kind of well known that it's hard to get different races together for labor efforts, and labor has kind of always had this history of being more segregated. So a lower diversity, higher risk of unionization, and also the rates of workers' comp claims. Team member sentiment is pretty self-explanatory. Just employees' feedback on quality and safety of their work environment and whether they feel supported and respected. And the article also kind of goes into the anti-union propaganda that Whole Foods is giving the workers. There's oftentimes at orientation, there's anti-union videos that you have to watch before you start working there. And also they kind of gave the line that's pretty common among anti-union efforts, that they value the individual members' agency in coming to managers with grievances on their own. You don't need a union. You can talk to your manager and with your concerns, and nothing bad will happen to you. I think they've been hitting that pretty heavily over the past couple years, this individual contribution line. Also, Amazon is in the news recently. They had a job application open that was asking for people who were for analysts that were preferably fluent in a second language and had prior experience in analytics from, quote, the intelligence community, the military, law enforcement, or related global security role in the private sector. Also from the listing, the analyst's key responsibilities would be to compile white papers and reports for senior company leadership with assessments of certain risk factors, the, quote, dynamic situations upon which the holder of the position would be expected to report include, quote, protests, geopolitical crises, conflicts impacting operations, and other, quote, sensitive topics. The analyst would also report on highly confidential matters, including labor organizing threats against the company, and they would also establish and track funding and activities connected to corporate campaigns, both internal and external, against Amazon. Last but not least, the analysts would help Amazon's in-house lawyers put together documents for use in court filings, quote, including restraining orders against activist groups, since legal uses intelligence assessments to demonstrate to courts of law that activist groups harbor intent for continued illegal activity vis-a-vis Amazon. After these job postings surfaced on the internet and were reported about widely, I found an article from ArsTechnica.com. Then these postings disappeared, and it was kind of said that it was a mistake that this job description was posted, and that they didn't mean to describe the activities of these postings in this way, which was pretty transparently false. One of the directors of Athena, which is an employee activist group that Amazon wants to gather intelligence against, is quoted in the article saying, "Workers, especially Black workers, have been telling us all for months that Amazon is targeting them for speaking out. This job description is proof that Amazon intends to continue on this course. Every single person in the United States has the right to speak up and to join with others to improve the conditions under which we live and work. and we have every right to demand better for our communities from a corporation worth $1 trillion. This article came out September 2nd, and the quote continues, "And since Monday is Labor Day, let's remember that Pinkertons and, quote, goon squads didn't stop communities around coal mines or auto plants or sugar plantations from organizing for real democracy in past centuries, and these intelligence analysts won't stop us now." So I think labor leaders are pretty well in tune with Pinkertons and other groups seeking to infiltrate and surveil these labor groups. So I think even though the toolkit that Pinkertons and other groups are using now are way more sophisticated, I think the fact that we have knowledge that these activities are happening can help arm us against being surveilled and being infiltrated. So I think knowing the history of the Pinkertons is pretty important, just so that we have this knowledge of the tools that they use. It would be really interesting to read that tell-all book that was published way back in the day to see if those are the same techniques and that are being used today. Also from The Verge, the news just came out that General Keith Alexander joined the board of directors for Amazon. So General Keith Alexander, if you don't know who he is, was the director of the NSA during the Edward Snowden leaks, and he was critical of the reporting that was going on the documents that Snowden released. So I think this just kind of signals that Amazon doesn't really have a problem with intelligence gathering kind of shady activities of surveillance of their workers and other people. If you've read anything about the NSA during that time, during the PRISM data gathering efforts, they were just ruled unconstitutional. So I think this is kind of a clear signal from Amazon that they're kind of doubling down on this intelligence gathering and this anti-union efforts and anti-worker efforts. One other thing from the Ars Technica article is that it was recently uncovered that Amazon is monitoring social media discussions of workers who use the Amazon Flex delivery app. Workers have been kind of complaining about this Flex app because it offers plum gigs to people that can reach an Amazon distribution center or a Whole Foods restaurant or a Whole Foods store the fastest. And so people have been hanging phones in trees outside of these distribution centers to kind of get the leg up on their fellow gig workers. So there's been a lot of complaints happening to Amazon and also on social media. This tool that Amazon uses was exposed on a website called Shark and Inc. The site had no obvious ties to Amazon, and the tool does not use traditional Amazon infrastructure, suggesting that Amazon wanted to keep the tool and its surveillance secret. After the story was published, however, Amazon did confirm that the information the reporters found was indeed genuine. Amazon was monitoring more than 60 groups. Employees were not supposed to make public the existence of the social media monitoring program, according to a page that was included among the files. This is quoted from the instructions. The information related to different posts reported out from various social forums are classified. Do not share without proper authentication. Most of the post/comment screenshots within the site are from closed Facebook groups. It will have a detrimental effect if it falls within the reach of any of our delivery partners. Do not share without proper authentication. So they were obviously aware that if people knew that they were being watched on these closed Facebook groups, they would stop sharing this information. So this is basically a mirror of what happened in the past. They're infiltrating these closed groups to keep tabs on them and to report back to the companies what workers are saying about them.
As always, all of the links that we've talked about today, all of our notes will be in a PDF up at arsenalfordemocracy.com. We almost always release one with each episode so that you can follow along or do more research. There's also stuff that we didn't really have a chance to get into, such as the Pinkertons' continued obsession, which they were obsessed all the way back in the 19th century with this, but protecting their own image legally in terms of how it's represented even in fictional media, which came up most recently with the Red Dead Redemption 2 video game, which is set during the late 19th century. Rachel, thank you so much for doing all the research about what the Pinkertons have been up to lately, as well as some of their peer groups following their sort of infiltration and spying model.
Thanks, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
And we'll be back on the air, as we said, for the rest of the fall with half-hour episodes. Rachel's going to be the main person with me, but Kelly and Nate will also be making appearances periodically as the topics demand it. And so we hope you'll stick around with us for the rest of the fall on arsenalfordemocracy.com and from WVUD.